Are you somebody that when you're riding in a vehicle with somebody else, you feel like you need to fill the dead airspace, or you can like let it ride?
I can just let it ride. Porter once when we were hunting last year, he's like, bro, you're going to talk right now? And I'm like, I don't have anything to say. We just got done hunting and glassing and sitting next to each other and we were talking the whole time. Like, what am I going to say now in the vehicle? We're just driving back to go to camp. And he just like wanted noise in the vehicle. He's like, he didn't want to listen to radio. He's like, I just want to chat it out.
Just
like,
fill the air with something.
Yeah. So I had to like make up a bunch of stuff to talk about. Sometimes I just like being silent.
Yeah. And I agree. And I like being comfortable with somebody enough to the point where it's okay that you both can just sit there in silence. Yeah. And neither of you feels awkward.
Yeah. That's true friendship right there.
Yeah. You don't feel like you have to fill the space. Uh-huh. Yeah. I agree.
Let the mind just relax.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we should do it on a podcast today. Just let it relax. Just sit.
I don't know if people would enjoy that much. Maybe they would. No,
they probably wouldn't. I won't do that either. I want to hear your thoughts, Drew.
You got a new softy hat on.
I does.
You do?
No, I said I does.
Oh, you does? You meant to say that?
Yeah, I did.
Gotcha. I was going to correct you like a fifth grade English teacher.
No. Oh, yeah. Got the softy 2.0 in blaze orange.
It took us a long time to get it blaze.
Yeah. I'm not sure the exact work that went into it, but I heard it was impossible before. And then we finally figured out how to get it, or probably had to do enough quantity.
I remember seeing samples that were just
not blaze.
Not blaze.
Yeah, not blaze. And so we finally got the right color and they're awesome because they're so comfortable.
Yeah, that's been a request for a long time. I know people always want us to do a blaze softy.
Yep. So that's going to be a perfect late season hunt on some of those states where, or other states that are early that required you wear an orange hat.
Do you rock the softy on a rifle hunt?
I will now. I definitely will now.
Gotcha.
Uh-huh.
Are you going to wear one on your hunt? Your big deer hunt?
No. No.
No?
Not required to wear orange there.
Not required at all?
No.
Well, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I should know that, but I don't. Probably because I don't rifle hunt that much.
You should, Drew.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, you got your hat on too.
I do. I don't know what this one's called. Twin tines, two tines.
Two bucks on there?
Two chains.
Two chains?
I don't know.
That's a slick hat.
Yeah, it's not a bad looking hat. It's got mm-hmm. a couple of muleys. I should probably take it off, right? Since it's got a couple of muleys on it.
You probably should.
Nah. I saw a couple of good muleys this weekend.
Yeah.
Which is good. Yeah. It was fun to see that there's still some good bucks kicking around. Mm-hmm. They look healthy. I was talking to Omar yesterday. Omar killed a nice buck on the archery hunt. And we were talking yesterday about how quickly it seems that they go from that orange summer coat to that gray, you know, like fall winter coat. It feels like it happens in like a week.
Mm-hmm.
But all the bucks I saw this weekend were all pretty grayed out already. Mm-hmm. Still in velvet. I think you probably got one another 10 days or so before all of them were slicked off. But I think guys are starting to kill a few bucks that are hard horned.
Yeah, I think Omar said he saw, maybe I'm getting this wrong, I talked to so many people, but I thought he said one of the bucks was stripped already.
Gotcha. Yep.
We're getting close.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, but they definitely got that gray coat on. Yes, we're going to do a podcast today, obviously, Brady and I, just the two homies.
Mm-hmm.
You guys listened to the podcast we did with Eric last week. We got a good response from that, so that was awesome. Hopefully that'll help people out.
Yeah, I love guys like that. You can tell very passionate and does all the work required to be like top of his game.
For sure. Dude, I love a good elk caller. Somebody that's really good at it. It's so fun to sit and listen to make elk sounds.
Yeah. I saw a couple comments on YouTube or like the last segment. We just did the calling thing. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know why we haven't made that into a reel on Instagram. Just like let them rip.
Yeah.
Just like, that's it. Just sounds. And then maybe put that as, you know, when people have like white noise makers or whatever on your phone to help your sleep at night.
Mm-hmm.
You should make that into something to help people sleep at night. Where you just listen to bugles. Like mm-hmm. you would probably rock that, right?
Yeah, that'd be good, man. I would love that if I got woke up by an elk bugle every day. Yeah. I could make that.
Or you're talking about an alarm clock. I'm talking to help you sleep. Like, I just want to fall asleep listening to some bugles.
Oh, gotcha. No, I don't know if I'd like that, but I could definitely wake me up in the morning. That'd get you
fired up.
Yeah, bright eyed and bushy tail. I'd be ready to rip. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was good with Eric. Good dude. And like I said, it was fun to just sit and listen to him call and make elk noises. And I love that stuff. But kind of on the piggyback of that, I thought today we would spend some time talking about shot placement. And I dove deep into pulling up a bunch of statistics just as far as like dimensions of an elk. Mm-hmm. So size of lung, size of heart, location. I thought it would be good to kind of run through that and then talk through some various setups as far as like where to aim, you know, what position the animal should be in, whether you should take a quartering two shot or frontal shot, and actually do some talking about the dimensions of your kill zone. Mm-hmm. So that would be good. And hopefully that'll help people. I know that, you know, the hunts are like full swing. There's definitely been a bunch of big archery bucks that have been killed already. I've been seeing a bunch of those roll in.
Yep.
Seen some big bulls, states like Utah and Nevada that have got archery seasons that open early. Definitely seen some giant bulls.
That bull we were looking at earlier.
Oh yeah, Nevada bull. That's my favorite bull of the year by far.
Favorite, yeah. That bull, sweet.
Yeah, did that get you going a little bit? Big old back scratchers. Looks like a cross between an elk and a caribou.
I mean, that bull is just unique in all sorts of ways. So yes, it's old, mature, and it's
bladed out sword.
Big.
It's so cool.
Big, yeah.
Yeah.
Big antlers are awesome.
Yeah. That bull I loved, and then I saw a big Utah bull that was shot early on, maybe even first day, in full velvet that looked like it probably had like 30-inch thirds and mass for days, which was super cool. So that was fun to see. But for most of us, I think elk hunting is kind of yet to come. I know that there's some people that are probably getting out right now. You've got states that open up like what, the 2nd of September, I guess, which today were the 3rd.
Today's the 3rd, yeah. So Colorado opened yesterday.
But I think for a lot of people that are probably still heading out into the field within the next 2 weeks, I would say is going to be prime time for elk hunting. So I thought it'd be good to talk about shot placement. And hopefully a lot of people that are listening to this, maybe they'll listen to it on their way out to their hunt, you know? Mm-hmm. So it'll be a good little reminder as far as like where to aim. And that's what I was kind of aiming for last week when we had Eric on. It was just like last minute tips and tricks on calling elk, you know? So I thought we'd talk about that today. We also have some just like new stuff I thought we should talk about, including this roadless rule, rescinded, potentially being rescinded. There's a comment period that's open from now until September 19th. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read that here in a sec, but we'll dive into that and maybe cover it and just give some thoughts on it. And then just any other random rambling. I've been following along with Randy Larson. Hopefully he doesn't mind me using his name. He's a professor at BYU. We had Brock mm-hmm. Mingle, and those guys worked together. And he was one of the favorite guests of anybody that we've ever had on the podcast, actually.
We need to have them on again.
Yeah, I know. We do. It would be maybe December, January would be good to do like a post-season roundup and just kind of talk about body conditions. Because we go from like extremes, right? So we have like the worst winter ever in like 22, 23, have some really bad ones, massive die-offs in Wyoming, kind of that Four Corners area of like Idaho, Wyoming, Utah, Nevada, maybe even mm-hmm. a little bit. Southern Utah had great water year. Arizona had a pretty good water year that year. We didn't really necessarily see like the major die-offs as far as winter goes. But now we're like opposite end of the spectrum. So now
extreme drought.
Yeah, like Southern Utah. I mean, terrible. I saw Cedar City, which I live. I think it said 77 years, I think it's been since it's been this dry. So it's been really droughty. And he had some interesting stuff. So I thought maybe we'd cover a little bit of that and talk about it. And hopefully we can fit it all in. But I guess before we get into it, we should probably talk promo.
Promo code. Hit us, trail.
Promo code. You can use the promo code podcast. Super simple. Just podcast when you sign up for a Go Hunt Insider membership. If you use that promo code, you're going to get $50 back in the Go Hunt gear shop that you can use towards the purchase of any gear that you want in the shop. We're always adding gear to the shop. I know as we move past archery seasons and you roll into those rifle hunts, there's all kinds of trinkets and things that you might need last minute that you could add to your kit to help you out when you're rifle hunting. But you know, Insider membership is a year round. It's the gift that keeps on giving, right?
It's true.
So I'm already thinking the other day. So I was hunting elk over the weekend. We could talk about that, but I was hunting spikes and cows in Utah, and I had some downtime the one afternoon, and I'm already thinking like, oh, what am I going to do next year for elk? Like what's the plans? And so I was already thinking about the points that I have in other states. Yep. I'm trying to figure out what tags I could potentially draw next year, what hunts I want to go on. You know, I've got mule deer points in a few states where I'm got, you know, over a decade for sure that I need to burn. So I've been thinking about those and, you know, thinking maybe I'll do a high country mule deer hunt next year in some state. So I'm thinking about burning points, but all that is available to me via my Research Insider account. I can start really kind of fine tuning and planning for the next year. Cause even though we're not even remotely into hunting season yet, I'm already thinking what's on the horizon maybe that I could potentially draw for next year. So
yeah, we've been adding some new things lately too, a little bit. We did that, updating the mobile app, and then on web too, we have this like enhanced profile feature. Mm-hmm. You can go in there, add a bunch of custom stuff to it. And yeah, it just helps, you know, everyone when they're commenting and doing all that stuff. And then just, you know, getting to know people a little bit more. You can have a little bio in there if you want to.
So people in click your profile.
In your profile. So people can click on your profile, see a little bit about you. You could add, you know, whatever details you want to add or have
none. I need to go through and update mine probably.
Yeah, you can add a username now as well.
Oh, gotcha.
Most people can, I obviously have my name and then I just put a username too, and you can add could change your photo, but now it's a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, do states you've hunted, species you're interested in.
Yep.
All that good stuff.
So. And I think it's okay if I float it. I think our intent moving forward is to increase insiders' ability to help each other, right? So we have the comment sections within the unit profiles.
Yep.
And if you go through the unit profiles in your insider account, you'll see that people will always, like, a lot of the times anyways, most profiles, they'll like, hey, reach out to me at this email address or call me at this phone number. I've had this tag. Mm-hmm. And we're moving towards making that more of a community feature and allowing people to much more readily communicate one to another and make hunt plans and get information from each other.
Yep. So that was a big hint. Hopefully you got what that is.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't come out right and say it, but we're moving that way.
You could come out right and say it.
I don't know when they're planning it to get it live and market it. So I don't want to say too much.
Yeah. Communication.
Communication. Yeah. It'd be good.
Peer-to-peer communication. Yeah. That kind of gives it away, but not really.
Yeah. Which is a huge value add, to be honest.
It really is.
I know that for me, like when I'm planning a hunt, one of the very first things I do is just cruise any kind of available public information that I can find. And a lot of times it is reaching out to other people that I know, you know, either are from that state or have hunted that unit, you know, maybe a guide or an outfitter, and just try to pick. And I'm not really asking for people's honey holes unless they're willing to give them up. But it is good that, you know, a lot of these tags are hard to draw, right? So if you draw a tag, limited entry elk tag in a state like Nevada or Utah, I mean, you know, you're immediately going on a waiting period, and then the chances of drawing that again in the future are pretty slim. So I think in a lot of cases, it makes sense that people are willing to help each other out.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I like helping people out. I think it comes back around. I think,
we had a guy come in the shop the other day, and Norris was like, oh, he's asking about some like elk info. And I'm like, elk info? I'm the last guy you would want to ask about elk info. I figured like, he's like, oh, if you can show him some map stuff. And I was like, okay, like, want me to send him some articles like about mapping tips? Then he came walking over, introduced himself to me, and, he actually had a tag in a spot where I've had an elk tag before. Mm. And so it's a very coveted elk tag.
Right.
I was like, okay, well, I'll show you some stuff right now on maps of where you might want to check out.
You hooked him up?
I hooked him up a little bit.
Nice.
So, yeah, it felt good to you know, give back like that.
Right on.
So, yeah, stuff like that.
Yep. I guess the long and short of that is get an insider account and use the promo code podcast. Brady and I, we'd appreciate it if you use our promo code.
Yes, we do.
So use it, spread it, spread the word podcast. With that, I guess, should we dive in and cover this little roadless ruling thing?
Let's cover.
Little. I say little, it's not little. It's got the potential to be, you know, pretty gnarly. So I guess I'm going to read some of this basically so I don't screw it up too bad. But so it says the USDA will publish a notice of intent to rescind the 2001 roadless rule protecting millions of acres of wild areas in the national forest, including 4.4 million. I got this from a site in California, which I don't know if I should have done that, but including 4.4 million acres in California. The total number of acres I looked at down here, it says it would apply to nearly 45 million acres of the nearly 60 million acres of inventoried roadless areas within the national forest system.
Mm-hmm.
It says the notice will quit. So there's a 21-day public comment period. I'm just going to read you guys, if you want to give feedback, you want to give comment, this is how you do it. Essentially, it's going to run from now. So it's open right now. You can comment from now until September 19th. And you can do it very easily by just visiting the website, which is regulations.gov. So they're accepting, so it's the USDA, they're accepting written public comment on the potential impacts of the proposal and alternative for roadless area conservation. It's interesting. So I've kind of just recently dove in more into this. I kind of wanted to understand both sides of the perspective, right? So, the rule was enacted by the Clinton administration in 2001, with tons of input and feedback from the public. And it established essentially a lasting protection for specified wilderness areas within national forests by prohibiting road construction and logging. The Trump administration has kind of obviously been, you know, if we look a little bit at the, you know, the bill that was potentially part or the part of the package in that bill to sell off public lands, kind of their, what's the word I'm looking for? Loosen environmental regulations, essentially. Yeah. Basically, my understanding is that it's an attempt to expedite or expand timber cutting. Timber cutting, I'm not against timber cutting by any means.
Yeah, I'm all for it in the places that we can do it.
I'm all for it as well. And the fact that I think if you look at the state of some of our national forests across the West, you know, where I live in Southern Utah, we had the 80,000 acre burn on the Monroe, right? There's a lot of roads and trails and a lot of access on that. There hasn't been historically a ton of logging, but I just look at a lot of the areas that I hunt or have hunted. I wouldn't say in particular that those forests are managed in a state that you're not going to get some of these big catastrophic wildfires. So I'm not against logging by any means. I totally get it and I understand it. I'm also not super excited about opening up 45 million acres of wilderness or roadless areas to roads and expansion and logging, a lot of logging and, you know, maybe mineral, you know, mining or something like that. So I think it was probably said best. I think I listened to a little blurb. Maybe it was Cal from Meat Eater did. The thing that he said that kind of resonated the most with me in regards to this is that he thinks it would require much more of a scalpel approach. And I apologize if I have misstated. I don't think that I did. But essentially, basically, he said, I think logging, great, but a much more of a scalpel than a blanket, right? To just throw a blanket over it and say, hey, we're going to repeal this and we're going to open it up to, you know, logging and road construction and expansion, I don't agree with. So I guess the point of this whole thing is I just wanted to bring it to people's, you know, bring it to the front of mind. I think you should do some research. Obviously I'm kind of a moron, so I'm not the I'm not the guy that can go super in depth.
Yeah.
But I will say, I think if you do have comment, I don't think that it's a good thing. I think that there's a better way to do this. So I would just encourage people, I guess, to submit their feedback. And you can do that, like I said, at regulations.gov. And you've got until the 19th of September to submit your comment.
Right now I'm looking at it and there is 20,243 comments received already as of September 3rd.
Okay.
So 20,000 comments received. I am with you, Trail. I am right now and all the information I have gathered on my personal research about this, I am against this as well. My thought why I'm against it is once you add roads to something, you have roads there.
And sure, they're there.
Yeah, they're there. And already, like, roadless areas are very pristine. It's very nice to go into some of those areas. The counter arguments, which I've read, so people say, well, it's opening up more access to people to enjoy these places. You can already access these places. Yes. You have to maybe hike
right
a lot further. And so people are saying, I mean, there's a lot of comments on the old Instagram that were like, these places should not be allowed just for the very fit and jacked human beings to be able to go back there. And they wish it was open for then everyone. That's why roads would be a good thing to go in there. Then I've seen a lot of counter arguments that, well, what do roads do? They increase vehicle traffic. They push animals away. Roads increase the chances of fires because not all fires, but a lot of fires are human caused from campfires and that sort of thing. So you're putting more roads in there to do that. But I don't know. I don't know if I believe this is the right solution per se. There's already a bunch of other, I don't exactly know, but we can go logging and do other things and manage other national forests. Mm-hmm. We don't have to touch places that are roadless.
Yeah.
And wilderness areas and kind of leave those as is, is why I see it.
Well, I think there's a reason why mapping platforms, ours included, has roadless areas, mm-hmm. right, as a layer, because I think it's always going to draw that sense of adventure. It's going to protect, you know, animals. It's going to give people the ability to, you know, hike, get away from other hunting pressure if they can, you mm-hmm. know, get back into some like more remote, untouched country where, you know, wildlife obviously find refuge, right? So I think it's some of my most favorite memories and some of my very favorite places to hunt are roadless areas. You know, you get away from people. I get a backpack, mm-hmm. you know, I don't hear side-by-sides and four-wheelers, you know, all over the place. So I love roadless areas and I love, you know, backcountry hunting.
It just feels pristine. Feels like you're going back in time.
For sure.
When there's no one there. Like you realize it takes a lot of effort to get back in those places, but I cherish them so much and I cherish that solitude. And it's one of the last best places we have are places that are untouched. Yeah. By humans.
It's nice to be disconnected and get back into some of that country mm-hmm. and live off your back and, mm-hmm. and hunt and, you know, hunt animals. I mean, you think it's fun to hear elk act like elk, you know, and be back there and bugling and, you know, have some refuge. I was going to, I'll round this out unless you get something more to say, but, this is from BHA. So BHA basically quote here from an article they put out said, rather than abandon this proven framework, which was this roadless act or rule, we encourage the USDA to look at alternatives to refine the rule and create an enduring framework that safeguards our backcountry hunting and fishing opportunities while working to adapt to today's wildlife or wildfire challenges. Walking away from it altogether likely enhances fire risk, degrades habitat, and erodes the backcountry character that is essential to our outdoor heritage. So I agree wholeheartedly with that statement. Not against logging, not against production by any means, but I would like to see a much more refined scalpel approach to the problem than just repealing it and basically saying, yeah, we're going to just build roads and cut it into roadless areas and log it and nuke it.
Yeah. That's a tough one.
Anyways, close that out. September 19th.
Submit your comments.
Yep. Submit your comments. Cool. I thought it'd be interesting. So you love mule deer, right?
Absolutely love mule deer.
And then we'll dive into shot placement, but we're a little bit all over the place, but I think it's okay. So I thought this was really interesting. We're talking a little bit about fire, right? Mm-hmm. Just barely and logging and that kind of thing. So we've had this burn, the Monroe fire, which is just north of where I live in Cedar City, right? The Monroe Mountains, a unit that I've spent a bunch of time on actually when I worked for the Forest Service. One of the questions that I think I've had this question recently, actually, from guys that have drawn tags, and I've had it over the years, people asking like, what animals do when you get hit with a wildfire, right?
Yep.
So I thought it was kind of cool. And again, I'm going to borrow this from Randy Larson. Hopefully he doesn't mind. But basically, he had this diagram of a doe. And he was like, what does wildfire do to wildlife, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting to touch on. He said that they haven't lost any animals that they had that were collared on that unit, which is cool because that was nearly an 80,000 acre burn. I think it's 95% contained at this point. So he had a diagram there on his Instagram page of a doe, and this doe was up on her summer range. And essentially, it looked like what she did is she just kind of skirted the edge of the fire and migrated to her winter range and spent some time in her winter range. And then it looked like she migrated back.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So she just went like a little out and back, right? You know, mm-hmm. she went on a little jaunt to essentially avoid that fire. But I thought that was really super. It was interesting. It was cool to see. He reiterates that it's important that we try to maintain migration corridors and then also summer range and winter range mm-hmm. so that those animals have somewhere to go. But I thought that was really cool just to see. So, you know, what do animals do when a fire blows through? They move.
They move. That's what they should do.
Yeah.
And it's important to have those places where they can move to, obviously, even during the summer when they wouldn't be going to their winter range, but have the option to, I guess, to get away from this. And then obviously she's moving back.
Yeah.
She already, so this doe is already moving back. currently?
Yeah, basically. So I'm trying to find the actual language that he used. But basically, he kind of indicated that it looked like for a time frame she moved, and it looked like she migrated back is what it looks like based on the little diagram that he had.
So you can kind of turn around and use some of this stuff too. They always say like, oh, when should you go hunt a burn after it's been burned? Yeah, I've seen deer on them instantly that same exact year when a wildfire came through, and this mm-hmm. kind of like in a way proves it with one. I mean, it's a sample size of one right here, mm-hmm. one collared doe already moving back to the area that was burned. Obviously, that area is no longer burned, probably in the area that she's moving back into, but already moving back because the place she wants to be.
Yeah, my brother was asking me this weekend what animals do when they burn, like how far, when do they move back in? And I remember having a conversation with a guy that I know that does some guiding, and he guides in an area that burned last year or within the last few years. Anyway, I know that they were, they had some archery hunters, and essentially they were killing elk. Like, so archery hunt ended, they filled those, they helped their clients, and then they had a couple of rifle permits, which is right after the archery hunt. So mm-hmm. late, you know, mid-September. So like 20th, 25th, something like that. They killed bulls in the burn, like same year. So that burn had gone through in like June, July. Yeah. And, you know, they were back in there hunting elk, killing elk in September, which is interesting. And then I got to thinking about it. And my brother was asking me about it. And I think it depends on the burn, the type of the burn.
Type of burn, the intensity of the burn, what's the vegetation like? Can it grow back easily?
Yep.
Are you getting some moisture right afterwards to then regrowth some of that stuff?
Yeah, exactly. I think the timing of the burn. So maybe if it's early summer, June, July, maybe you get a little monsoon rain in, you know, August, and you get maybe a little bit of regrowth popping up.
Yeah.
And then also, I mean, does the burn absolutely nuke the landscape? Like, is there no standing live pockets of timber? And I think he notes here that there's it kind of mosaiced out, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got some areas that burned really hot and intense and, you know, leveled everything. There's really no understory. And then you've got some remaining live pockets of timber. And I think as long as you've got that kind of framework, I think those animals probably move right back in. And then I think it gets progressively better. And I've always kind of thought maybe that like 10 to 15 year window is kind of the most prolific and, you know, productive for forage.
Yep.
But yeah, that was really interesting. The other thing that he noted, that I thought I would just talk about a little bit, he put in here, a graph, and it's a north to south gradient in 6 month old survival of, mule deer fawns in Utah. And he says it's bookend by the highest survival in 10 years on the cache, so northern Utah, mm-hmm. To the lowest in 10 years on the southern units of the Pine Valley. And he talks about drought, right? As we talked about it earlier, but it was crazy to see kind of the various gradients of survival of fawns. Drought, man. Drought is so hard.
Drought's one of those big, big killers that you hate to see.
Yeah. It's just
so even crazy. After all the wet years down south, southern Utah, yep. and then a year drought, you're instantly seeing fawns dying.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the severe drought, obviously. Mm-hmm. I would say last year was pretty droughty.
Yeah.
Winter was not great. Not a lot of snowpack, not a lot of rain. We have gotten some rain like the last 2 or 3 weeks, which is nice and it'll help. But I think for the most part, man, I just wish we could get some consistency. We need mm-hmm. Mother Nature. All you guys that are, you know, into that woo-woo stuff, if you guys could just do some rain dances or whatever it might be. But yeah, if we could just get some like consistency where we just get like 100% of snowpack and then maybe some monsoons in the summer where it just wasn't these extremes of like hard winter, super drought for years and years.
Constantly facing something, whether it's, mm-hmm. you know, all, like I said, drought, winter kill, and then you got roads, and then you got winter areas, summer range, like all this stuff keeps being touched, and you just have a rough time right now. Very, very rough time out there.
Yeah. I did see a lot of fawns, which was great. Saw a lot of fawns that were, you know, twins mm-hmm. and with does and, which was good, but yeah, we just need some consistency.
I haven't noticed seeing a lot of fawn does when I've been scouting lately.
You have been?
No.
Have not? Mm-mm. Gotcha.
There's definitely a few, and I'm like, maybe are they hiding, doing whatever? But like the fawns I do see are obviously with their moms,
mm-hmm.
but I'm seeing lots of other does walking around, and I'm like a whole area would be like, you know, 10, maybe 15 does, and there'd be like two fawns.
Wow.
Like no joke.
I've seen a lot.
Really?
Yeah. I had a lot of does with twins too, which was good. And the area that I hunt isn't, it's not an area that I would say has a robust deer population. At least it hasn't. And I was telling my brother, it's interesting. So this area that I like to hunt had a fire a number of years ago, a few decades ago. It's been interesting in my lifetime to like see the conversion of early succession species like grasses, you know, some small forbs and stuff to now where I go out on that landscape. And it's like a lot of rabbit brush. Well, in the bottoms, there's some rabbit brush, but a lot of bitter brush, a lot of sagebrush. So like a lot of those big benches and stuff are now like the dominant species is sagebrush, which is great for mule deer. And it does seem to me, at least like in the last maybe 5-6 years, as I've been, you know, hunting that area more intensely, like I'm seeing more deer, more fawns, more does with fawns. Like it just seems like it's coming back.
I don't want to dive too much into the deer things. I want to get to elk shot placement.
Sure.
But is this because of Utah does a really good job of reseeding after fires, or is it just naturally coming back?
I think it's just natural progression of things. You know, I mean, initially you have a fire, you're going to have that early succession species, which are going to be your forbs, your small, you know, small vegetation. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to have your grasses that are going to come back. And then it just takes time for shrubs like sagebrush, bitterbrush to establish and compete. And then once they do, they start to branch out. And then you know, your dominant species then becomes your browse species like sagebrush and bitterbrush. I just think it takes time. I didn't know how long because I hadn't really, I mean, I'm in my 40s at this point, but I haven't really had a chance until recently to like notice like, okay, this is a burn that happened when I was in my early 20s. And now 20 some years later, 25 years later, I'm actually seeing and observing, and it's a unit that I've hunted enough to like, yeah, I can actually physically go out on the landscape and I can remember when it looked like this and now it's starting to look like this. Like I can definitely see the transition, which is pretty cool. And it feels like, you know, it feels like it's good for deer.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
Yeah, it's neat. Yep. Shot placement. You want to talk shot placement?
Let's talk shot placement.
What do you know about it?
Put the arrow projectile in the right spot and you'll get the correct result.
Yeah.
That's what I know.
Do you have any like hard rules or anything like that? Like over the years, like, yeah, you remember going through hunter safety. It's probably been many moons ago, but do you remember what they teach you?
Broadside shots only. Is that what they taught you back in the day?
Yeah, broadside. I remember we talked about, like, I took my youngest kid through hunter safety and they talk about like quartering away shots a little bit. They talk a little about shots you shouldn't take.
Picking where the arrow is going to exit, not where it's going to enter, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing. But yeah, I don't ever remember like getting dimensions.
Do you think, yeah, maybe they're just taking the basics and be like, all right, here's an animal. This is where you should put it, but not diving in any further than that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought we would talk about a little bit, maybe one of the best things to do is we can just dive in and talk about measurements. I thought this would be interesting because I think I've killed a lot of elk, killed a lot of deer. But I didn't know that I've ever really like dove in and kind of pulled some hard facts and figures about the dimensions of an elk. Mm-hmm. So basically what I found, height. So from the belly, the brisket, just behind the front leg to the top of the back, which is kind of where the hump is on an elk.
Yep.
Anywhere from 28 to 32 inches.
Okay.
So roughly 30 inches would be a lot. 30 inches is roughly it. I read a bunch of forums where people had said, yeah, I actually measured my, I was surprised there's a lot of people have actually taken this measurement.
I think it's becoming more popular to do anatomical measurements on your animals so you know exactly what you're dealing with.
Yeah, I think it's interesting for sure. So I would say anywhere, you know, 28 inches to maybe 30, 32 inches. So, cool. You know, roughly, what is that, 3 feet? No, just
36 is three.
Yeah, 36 is three. So a little less than 3 feet. Mm-hmm. Width of the chest cavity.
Okay.
You have any ideas what you'd think an elk would be?
Width. So you're looking straight on?
Yeah, straight on. So yeah, width.
Okay.
What would you
22?
Get? 22 to 24 inches.
Dang,
that's what good. They say. So about 2 feet wide.
Yeah.
So you're essentially like 2.5 feet from hump to brisket.
Okay.
Right. And you're like 24 inches. So 2 feet wide. elk lungs. I thought it'd be interesting. So overall size, each lung is roughly the size of a football, sometimes bigger in a mature bull. So average lung length is about 12 to 18 inches long, front to back.
Okay.
So 12 to 18, so it's about just over a foot width. So you're talking, again, if you're looking at it head on, right? Mm-hmm. 8 to 10 inches at the widest point.
Okay.
And then thickness, lung thickness, it says about 4 to 6 inches at the fattest section when inflated. So you're talking, you know, 4 to 6 inches each lung, right? Yep. Because you got the two parts.
Two parts.
I thought this was interesting. Combined volume estimates that an elk's lung capacity is about 10 to 12 liters of air. In comparison, a human average lung is about 6 liters.
Dang, just think I've had those lungs, how fast I can and far I could run.
Yeah, man. Can you imagine if you had 10 liters worth of lung power? You could run 200 miles, no problem, Brady.
What are the VO2 maxes on an elk?
I don't know. A lot. So why this matters. So for bow hunters, why it matters. On a broadside shot, the lungs create roughly a 14 to 18 inch tall by 12 to 15 inch wide target area, which is roughly the size of a basketball.
Okay. Basketball, that's your...
That's your
kill.
Your kill zone, essentially, your lung zone. Yep. So the location of the lungs, then we'll talk about the heart here in a sec. Mm-hmm. So location fills most of the rib cage, wrapping around the heart. It extends from just behind the shoulder blade back about 14 to 16 inches. Vertically, they run from just above the sternum, the low chest, to about halfway up the elk's body depth.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, what do you think most people, I think at least this is me speaking. I think a lot of the shots that I've missed where I've hit an animal, I've hit them not forward or back. So not necessarily a shoulder blade or, and I have had that happen, but not necessarily a shoulder blade or guts. My misses have mostly been high.
Okay. Like a complete miss you're talking about.
Yeah. Like where I've hit an animal and hadn't retrieved it. Most of my shots have been high.
Okay.
One of the reasons I think is because when you shoot a bow, I come from the top down.
Top down. Yep.
Do you?
Top down always. But I had that little issue that all archers don't like to talk about. So I always end up, once I get settled, it naturally wants to drift low.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I usually, when I miss before, will miss low.
Yeah, my shots have been high, and I was thinking about this. So so where to shoot on a broadside elk? An elk standing broadside represents the best bow hunt shot. It's the least amount of penetration, essentially, right, to reach the organs.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm pulling some of this from the internet. Adjusting for the needed elevation correlation in the aiming spot, you find the best aiming spot on a broadside elk standing by going up the back of the front leg, third to halfway up the chest cavity, and just a few inches back.
Okay.
So when I think about that, if you're talking best aiming point, a third of the way up to a half the way up chest of the chest, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people, maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but I think my primary aiming point has been probably too high.
Because you're not leaving yourself much room there,
above.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
The other thing I was thinking about is like when I aim at an elk coming down on it, if you've got any target panic or if you are rushing your shot, if you're like, okay, pin, hide, and you're coming down from mm-hmm. above, I think there might be an indication to rush a shot, get a shot off high, which is one of the reasons why I wonder if that's the reason or causation because why I might miss high.
Do you find that some of the elk you're shooting, are they hearing string and kind of loading the body to move too? So they're also kind of ducking down a little bit. So it's accentuating that high shot to be even higher.
Yeah. See, that's interesting. So I've only ever had one elk that I would say that I think ducked the string. And I know for a fact that he did, cause we have it on video, but there was a knot on a tree, essentially aspen tree. And you can see, and it was about a 55 yard shot, but from the time that the string went off, you know, to the arrow, you can see he probably ducks, I would say 8 to 10 inches. Hmm. I've only ever had that one happen one time, but it's certainly a possibility. I think elk are much less likely to duck the string than a mule deer or an antelope or something like that. Certainly like, you know, an axis deer, I think, which absolutely comes uncorked, or a coos deer, which is crazy. But, yeah, I think if you're going to air, I would say air to the bottom third of the body.
Okay. Bottom third. Are you also erring on the fact you don't want to come towards the shoulder and you're going to go more mid body then too? Or am I jumping ahead of what you're trying to get to here?
No, you're great. I would say, man, I read something the other day online when I was kind of prepping for this. I read where a guide or an outfitter had said, and this is for whitetail, but you could take it for what it is, right? So if you're going to miss back.
Okay.
Don't miss forward. He said that, again, this is a guided hunt in a more controlled environment, but basically he said they find like 95% of the animals that are gut shot in the abdomen, which is obviously not a great death for an animal. And we can talk a little bit about that here.
95%.
Yeah.
Okay. I am one of the 5%.
That didn't find one. Gotcha. Yeah. And I don't think it's like, and maybe that's high. And like I said, it's a controlled environment, and I don't know. I don't know the complete, you know, process that those guys are using, if they're using a dog to find it or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. But I would say back is better than forward. If
with a bow.
With a bow. Yeah. With a bow. Yeah. With a gun. Yeah. I'm speaking specifically of a bow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Broadhead. You know, obviously a gun, you put it through the front shoulder, you break the shoulder blade, you'll kill the animal, right?
Yep.
The shock. But I would say with a bow, I think back is better than forward. So for me, I'm aiming, you know, maybe 3 or 4 inches off kind of that crease, if you will, and half to a third. So lower. Mm-hmm. And this is a good reminder for me, because like I said, the shots that I have not had great luck with, I feel like my aiming reference has been too high. Yeah.
So then you're hoping at that point, the only thing you're really saving grace is catch top part of the lung.
Yeah.
When you shoot high, that's all you have. Where if you do go lower, you got the heart, you got more lungs right there. You got a lot of stuff going on in that area that you actually could hit. So yeah, to me, it does make sense that you should go lower. Now, obviously not talking brisket, but like you're aiming that lower, that third body up, whatever, a little bit back, about the same distance back. And that's where you should aim on an elk.
Yep. A third to a half.
Okay.
So kind of that space, if you think about it, looking at an elk, you know, and if, what is that?
Like I'm looking right now, obviously I've been testing out, Jay and Blake's horn score apps. They have anatomical measurements on here. So top of the back to bottom of the belly, 30 inches roughly.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be 10 inches. It'd be a third.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 inches from the belly up. And then, you're looking at, maybe about that same distance, eight inches off the shoulder to the back.
Yep. The back of the lung.
Okay.
Yep. So yeah, if you think about that, like the dimensions of an elk, so 30 inch chest cavity, right? Yep. And you kind of already said it. So 10 inches is a third, half, 15.
15.
So 10 to 15 inches.
That's a lot.
It's 5 inches right there, essentially.
What's,
right there.
What's above the lung?
Well, no man's land.
No man's land.
And we talk about that, right? So that space between like the top of the lung, bottom of the spine, just for kicks and giggles, I actually pulled up just to see. So, you have the spine, which is roughly like 1.5 inches thick, right? Above that, you have the bone part of the spine that goes up, up to the back. What's your back? If you think about an elk, you have the back strap.
Do you know what that bone's called?
I do. Let me find it.
I'm just trying to put you on the spot, because like I would explain it the same way you do, and I'm sure there's
dorsal
like
processes.
Ooh. Getting all scientific.
Yeah, so dorsal.
So how tall is that?
So the sources that I read said 5 to 6 inches. That feels a little large to me. And again,
if it's a 30 inch body, you got 5 to 6 there, and you're saying like a 2 inch spine.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're at, let's say, 8 inches. Mm-hmm. So then those other things are saying to hold high mid body, you're literally not leaving yourself any room to hit a lung.
No.
It's like the margin of error is greater if you try to aim something halfway up the body and touching a little bit higher with a bow.
Yep.
So yeah, I wish I had a visual right now to draw.
You see me we could pull one up. Maybe we can get Omar to put one up. But yeah, you've got the back straps, obviously, and you've got those bones, those dorsal processes, which they say are 5 to 6 inches mm-hmm. potentially on a mature bull. I would say they're maybe 4 to 5 inches if you think about the size of a back strap. You've got the spine itself, and you've got that gap between that and the top of the lungs. But primarily, I think, you would err on lower. So, mm-hmm. Lower on that body, the chest cavity than I have probably historically thought about. I've always just thought like, mid body, which I think, sure, mid body is great, but mid to lower third is better.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Based on what I'm looking at and how you're describing it, anatomical, about an elk, all the innards. Yeah. Lower portion.
Mm-hmm.
Third of the way up, 8 inches back from the leg.
Pretty safe. The full extent.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. You want some statistics on elk heart?
Yeah.
So length. Sorry, I got a frog in my throat. Roughly 6 to 8 inches. Width, 5 to 6 inches. Thickness, 3 to 4 inches.
So is that like a mango?
They say it's about... Yeah, mango would probably be a good guess.
Yeah.
I was trying to think here. Let me look and see if they actually made... It might have been like a softball size, essentially. Maybe a little bit larger, I guess. So the location of the heart. The heart sits low in the chest, directly behind the front leg, the elbow joint, when the elk is standing broadside. It angles slightly back and towards the lungs, with the apex pointing down and forward. Imagine a vertical line straight from the back edge of the front leg. The heart lies just behind and above that line. Broadside elk, the heart is a third way up the body from the brisket line. So if the chest cavity is approximately 30 inches, the heart is approximately 9 to 10 inches from the bottom of the brisket.
Heart is 9 to 10 inches from the bottom of the brisket.
Yep.
So again, that's that third area. That leaves you more margin of error from the upper part. Yeah, to hit things.
Yep. Do you want to know about elk liver?
I don't know anything about elk liver besides for it's tasty.
Yeah. So elk liver, the length, 14 to 18 inches, height, 10 to 12 inches, thickness, 3 to 4 inches, it says. It sits back and behind the heart and the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
It will kill. So if you shoot an elk in the liver, it will kill it. And we should probably say, so if you hit an elk in the heart, it's going to die typically within 100 yards. Goes pretty quick. Kills them quick. Lungs, same thing. You're talking probably less than a minute, I would say. A double lung especially. Heart blood, it's going to be bright blood. It's going to bleed profusely because it's going to hit low in the body. Mm-hmm. Usually your impact point's low in the body in a heart shot. They're going to bleed like crazy because it's a low shot. It's close to the ground, close to the bottom and part of their chest, and it's going to bleed like a mofo. And then lungs, obviously, they typically bleed pretty quick. And the telltale sign of a lung shot, you're looking for that frothy, pinky blood versus a heart shot, which is kind of that bright red color.
Okay.
Liver, bright, not bright, kind of a greeny, dark color, almost like a maroon color, right? Heart shot, lung shot, they're going to go pretty quick. Liver will kill them, typically 3 to 4 hours.
3 to 4 hours, damn.
They say. And then you can, usually when I shoot an elk, I think one of the first things you should do is just check your arrow, right? Look at your arrow, see what the blood looks like on your arrow itself. Is it meaty? Does it have meat on it? If it's meaty, it's probably not a great sign. Telltale sign maybe of a back strap or shoulder hit or something like that, or even a hindquarter. Mm-hmm. If you really don't know where you hit. Guts obviously going to be brown, kind of a grossy color. Liver blood's going to be kind of a dark maroon. A lot of times they'll hump an animal when you hit it in the liver. It'll kind of hump, take a few steps, and it looks a lot like an animal that's gut shot.
Yeah,
kind of that traditional like hump up, and they're just not feeling great, and they won't go normally very far, but they will lay down and die, but it usually takes 3 to 4 hours is what they say. But if you add it all up, right? So you've got lungs, liver. So lungs and liver, you've got about a 25-inch window there. it's a pretty big hunk of real estate. Mm-hmm. Ideally, lung is best. Heart's great. But if you do hit it in the liver, like I said, which is going to be fatal, it's going to be maybe harder to track. But it's a big chunk of country there. So I think your biggest issues are aiming too far forward.
Mm-hmm. Hitting the shoulder.
Hitting a shoulder. And then hitting too high, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Will a shoulder shot ever kill an elk with a bow?
It will. So it just depends. So I pulled a little information. An elk scapula, the shoulder blade, can vary in thickness. On the low end, it can measure a mere quarter inch.
Okay.
Which is, if you think about a scapula, what it looks like, you got that ridge that runs up the middle of it, mm-hmm. right? Then you have either side of it where that bone is thinner.
Yep.
So quarter inch up to 2.5 inches on the center.
Yeah.
So if you're at the edge of that scapula, I think there's a chance, right? That you're going to punch through that scapula and you'll get enough penetration. I did also find out that you need about 12 to 18 inches of penetration to cause enough damage and trauma to kill the animal.
So it might better be close.
Yeah.
If you want as much energy as you can behind that arrow to punch through the scapula to then enter in something vital near there.
Yep. So to that question, if you hit it on the quarter inch part of the scapula, there's a high likelihood that you'll punch it through. I think if you hit it center of the scapula, which is 2.5 inches thick, every broadhead test I've ever seen where people on YouTube have shot an arrow into the center ridge of that scapula, it's not penetrating enough. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. At least in the videos I've seen, you might be able to prove me wrong here. Maybe somebody has. I haven't seen it in the testing I've seen online, but essentially, like, you center punch that ridge, that scapula, where it's 2.5 inches thick, like, you're not punching it through.
So all those guys who want to shoot a 600 grain arrow because it's got so much
momentum,
energy, momentum, penetration properties, and they claim potentially that they're going to bust through an elk shoulder. Probably not going to happen.
Probably not going to happen unless you hit it right in, like, in the thin part of the scapula. No. Yep. Yeah. Which, you know, you can debate broadheads all day long, but, I just don't think it's better back than forward. I mean, you've got a big chunk of real estate there behind the shoulder blade that you'll effectively kill an animal as long as you're low, half to a third lower in the body than you will if you aim forward. Other interesting things that I found: elk rib, approximately an inch to an inch and a half wide.
Okay.
And then you have about an inch between ribs. So, you know, it's a softer tissue though. And everything that I looked at, pretty much anybody's broadhead's going to punch through ribs. It's just a softer material.
So it's going to break through it. So you're not going to be like, oh, I'm the one unlucky person who squared a rib.
I'm not going to say it's impossible. I'm just saying, for the most part, it's a softer tissue.
Most likely it could hit and slightly deflect, and those ribs do kind of move.
Yep.
And so most likely it's going to find its way in there.
A little more pliable. Yeah. Okay. Ideally you want to hit between those two ribs, right? Mm-hmm. But it does make a case. It's interesting. Like, if you, if you're shooting a 2-inch expandable, if that expandable is like set in the fact that it can't like pivot like a sever or a beast broadhead where you've got the spring loaded, mm-hmm. those have got some give to them. It is interesting that you may, you probably increase your chances of getting some deflection trying to punch it between two ribs, unless it hits vertically. If it hits horizontally between two ribs and you're shooting a 2.3-inch broadhead or a 2-inch broadhead, you're probably going to get some deflection.
So it could be going in straight, all of a sudden hits there and deflects, and I was kicking back.
Could.
Or kicking forward. Don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And you could miss some stuff. Wow. So you guys could say, like, oh, I hit it right behind the shoulder, but it may have deflected on a rib and you don't know. Because obviously you didn't recover the animal.
Yeah. Quartering away. So quartering away shot. You kind of already touched on it a little bit, but for me, a quartering away shot, it's the same as far as the height goes on the body. But I always look for the biggest tip I could give you in regards to quartering away is aim for the opposite front leg. And it may have to change a little bit. Like, if it's quartering real hard, I may not take that shot because I don't necessarily want to like punch it right through, guts, liver, and one lung. But on a slightly quartering away, my advice would always be just aim. You got to kind of picture where that opposite front leg sits. And if you punch it right through there and you're aiming for that opposite front leg, you should get both lungs.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about, there's a lot of people that say cording away shots are not great shots to take.
Have you heard that? Is it because people are just concerned about not getting two holes? Because it could hit that opposite shoulder and lodge in there. But then my counter to that would be, if you hit the opposite shoulder, it lodges in there, and then the animal's moving, arrow snaps. Now that's more things in there that's going to be destroying all the vitals with a couple, two pieces of a broken arrow.
Yeah, so that's one argument. The other argument is the elk stomach. So if you're shooting a cording away, it's hard cording away, and elk stomach's full of grass and browse, can slow or actually stop an arrow from reaching vital organs.
I don't know.
What do you think about that?
I mean, everything's so like, I don't know. It's like, it has material in there. Obviously it's grass and stuff, but like there is also water and all sorts of stuff, bacteria breaking stuff down. So it's actually like, your arrow's still like, not lubed is the right word, but like there's still some lubricity as it's going through there.
Sure. Yeah.
It's not like you're hitting a bunch of dry material from the hay field. You know,
it's
like
soft tissue, right? Yeah. If you think about an elk stomach, if you ever dove into one, it's a bunch of mashed up vegetation.
Yeah, and it's pretty wet.
Yeah. I've never experienced this. I have shot at least two bulls that I'm thinking of off the top of my head that were quartering away. One of them more so than the other. In both cases, I did not get pass-throughs. I basically buried the broadhead in their off front shoulder. Both of them were double lung. Both of them died really quickly. In fact, I watched the one bull die probably less than 100 yards from where I shot him. I love the quartering away shot. It's as long as it's not too quartering away, right? Yeah. So I guess my advice and my thought process is if you're aiming or you're having to aim behind what you would think like the last rib is, it's probably not a great shot.
Too much of a quartering away.
Probably too quartering, because then at that point, I think you're really only probably going to get that off front lung.
Yeah, you're not going to get that front side at all.
Yeah, you're not going to, you probably miss it. You probably get liver, liver and lung, and it'll probably kill it. I just don't know that you're going to get you're going to increase the chance of like a good blood trail and then probably finding that animal. And you're probably going to get some guts on it for sure.
Yeah, this is a totally different animal, a lot smaller, but of all the antelope I've killed with my bow, the majority of them, for whatever reason, I'm always spotting and stalking them. I've never killed one from a ground blind yet, but they're always kind of walking away from me. The last little bit when I'm stalking them, I haven't really always had a perfectly broadside shot, so it's always quartering away. And I literally have in my freezer still, I was looking at the other day when I was doing some organizing, I have two opposite front shoulders where I got the broadhead still like embedded into it. And those antelope died in like 20 yards. So hard cording away, not like too hard, but like goes and hits the opposite shoulder. My arrow, like I said, broke. And literally no joke, the animal was dead. Antelope was dead in like 20 yards, 30 yards. Yeah. Like they pile up super quick. And that's an antelope, it's not an elk. But it's like, I always like a quartering away shot. It's always been a great one.
So this antelope that I just shot, a month ago, I guess, at this point. Has it been a month? Yeah, it has been a month. Dang. So it was slightly quartering away. Same thing. I hit right. If you think about an antelope, you've got the square, essentially white square. You can picture it on an antelope. Hit right behind the pin, quartering away, and it went through and went through the opposite shoulder blade. But this is even on an antelope. You think about an antelope scapula, it's not even compared to an elk, right? But that broadhead only went through maybe inch and a half on the other side. So I did get, two holes in the animal, but it punched through. But you gotta be careful with those scapulas.
Yeah. I should bring that bone in and show you once. I think it's a G5. This was like no joke, probably like 2009, 2010, but like the broadhead's like literally embedded into the bone, and I have it like all boiled out. It's kind of cool. I've just kept it for whatever reason.
It's in the opposite front shoulder, on the outside. Okay, well, what kind of broadhead?
G5, whatever those expandables were back in the day, the three blades.
Dead meat?
No, this is 2008.
Huh? Yeah, I don't know what that would be. Interesting. Let's talk.
It kind of looks like the dead meat in a way, but it's not the dead meat. It was named something else way back in the day.
Yeah, I don't know what it would be. Let's talk the frontal, one of the more controversial.
Here we go. I mentioned you earlier. I'm going to spin your world.
Yeah, do you want to ask your question?
Is a frontal shot on elk ethical?
Yeah, I think it is.
Is it determined by distance? If you're going to take a 50 yard shot on a frontal, is that a doable shot? or is it more ethical and more lethal if you try to get 20, 30 yards, like you have a bull come straight in on you?
I would say, man, here's the thing. Cause it's really hard for me to say like, what is ethical for somebody, right?
It always is. Yeah. The ethical maybe
yeah,
the wrong
I'm
word.
Not,
I chose,
I'm not.
Maybe I chose the wrong word there, but like, is it still lethal at 50 yards?
It's lethal. It's going to be lethal. I mean, okay. So essentially what I found out, maybe this will help me answer. So essentially, man, and I looked in a lot of different places. This seems large to me, but this is what I found. So according to the World Wide Web, the pocket and a frontal shot is a where you can actually get an arrow into it, right? So above above the sternum essentially is about 12 inches, which is pretty big.
Okay.
That seems big to me.
Yeah.
But given an elk, you figure he's 2 feet wide, 24 inches wide, right?
Okay.
And you kind of picture the rib cage. I mean, I guess I could see where there might be, you know, 12 inches there of a pocket where you could squeak an arrow in frontal. Now, 12 inches is that's a big window, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not Levi Morgan or Bodie Turner, right? So for me to say, like, is it lethal and ethical for one of those guys at 60 yards? It might be. I mean, those guys can. They can probably put 99 arrows out of 100 at 60 yards and a 12, probably more than that, probably 100 of 100 at 60 yards. So yeah. I'm not going to say that it's not, or that it's unethical. I would say for me, and maybe just like as a general advice, it's a smaller window.
Okay.
Like you have, your margin of error is less.
So you should hope people would think about that the margin of error on a frontal shot is a lot less.
A lot less.
It's a lot less in terms of does he have to penetrate through so much stuff to get to the vitals, or you got, you know, the esophagus right there, you got thicker hide,
sure,
the longer mane of an elk, yep, right there.
Yep. Thicker hide, mane, the whole thing, longer hair. But if you hit that window, like it's soft tissue. I've shot elk frontal. And had them completely eat the entire arrow, like had the arrow buried in the back hip, you know what I mean? Like through everything and died very quickly. You know, I shot a bull last year frontal at probably 11, 12 yards, I would say, died really, really quick. It's an extremely lethal shot. Like animals, the elk that I've killed, antelope I've killed that I've shot frontal have died some of the quickest I've ever killed.
Yeah, I still remember that antelope when we were hunting together. We hunted together with Neville. The funnel
what
shot
you go,
took
30
on.
Yards, maybe?
Yeah, and that swath of a blood trail from that spot to where, I mean, you see him dead 30 yards, but like the blood was just insane.
Yeah.
And it literally almost penetrated through the whole entire cavity.
Yeah. The other thing I think about is hard about aiming. I think one of the issues is aiming at an elk frontal.
Do you think more people are more apt again to probably shoot it high?
Probably
because you're looking at the bull, you can see the bottom brisket. You don't want to hit there. You're thinking you're going to go up, but then you can't see maybe the behind the bull. You can't see the top of his back.
It's hard to picture it, right?
It's hard to picture if it's looking straight at you.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about if you think of an elk and he's standing there looking right at you, there's a depth perception because his neck and his head sticks out ahead, right? Of the actual vitals or the insert point of your broadhead where you're going to hit it on a frontal shot. Whereas if you're shooting in an elk broadside or quartering away, it's like this nice flat surface essentially, right? It's not flat, but you get my point, right?
Yeah.
It's much different than a neck extending from a body looking at you. So aiming, I think, is hard. And it's also, I think, hard to aim just as a process. It's hard to aim at an elk frontal because his head, his antlers, he's like looking at you. Like it's just hard to aim. It's way more nerve wracking in my opinion. I think so. I don't know that it's unethical or ethical. I think it depends on the individual. I think it depends on your abilities, you know, to keep your shit together and actually make and take that shot.
Is it also, it's also probably one of the situations where if you're hunting elk by yourself solo and you are calling and moving in, could you say that that's a situation you could be presented with more because the elk's going to come right towards the sound and you're going to get that frontal view of an elk?
Yeah.
And you're hoping he's going to turn at the last second, but a lot of times they don't. And all of a sudden he's at 12 yards. And it's like, what are you doing? He's at 12 yards. He's going to run away.
Yeah. I mean, I read online here, somebody had said like, oh, it's, you know, kind of a rare occasion when you're going to be presented with this frontal shot. In my experience, it's super common.
Yeah.
Like, so I would say more times than not, I'm presented with an animal, you know, an elk when you're calling it in where it comes in and it's frontal.
Can I ask how many bulls have you killed frontal? Do you remember?
Three. Yeah.
Which is a, happens.
It's not insignificant.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's a decent number.
Have you ever passed on a frontal shot?
Yeah, I have. I'm just thinking about
what was the situation why you decided to pass?
And that's the other thing.
It wasn't quite exactly quite, straight on.
Yeah. See, and here's the thing is like, I've hunted enough and I've been out in the woods and experienced like calling situations and had elk in and out of ranges. They can appear different, right? So like you could shoot an animal and you're like, yeah, he was perfectly broadside. Then when you get up to the animal, you're like, actually he wasn't, he was slightly quartering away or quartering two, you know, they just the perception of that animal. And I think you could probably get that the same thing. And that's probably an argument for taking frontal shots close so that you have a much more defined idea of the way that elk is actually standing, right? Versus if he's standing at 50 yards, you're like, is he totally frontal? Is he quartering two? I mean, it's kind of hard to tell, right?
Yeah, because you could enter in that frontal if he's quartering two or whatever, then all of a sudden, boom, you're in the opposite shoulder, like instantly.
Yeah, exactly. And that's taking a frontal shot. You know, you're worried about the two shoulder bones. You picture an elk, you've got those two shoulder bones that sit either side. And then you're worried about the sternum, which obviously sits low in the chest. So basically on a frontal shot, aim high in the center of the chest. So about 6 to 9 inches above the sternum. Okay. Which is the point of the breastbone to target the heart and lungs when taking a frontal shot,
excuse me,
while avoiding the heavy shoulder bone. So you don't want to be too far left, too far right. You kind of want to be, you know, if you think about, you're looking at an elk's chest, he's 2 feet wide, kind of center.
Okay.
So right. And 6 to 9 inches high of the base.
So you got the base of them, 6 to 9 up, center between, obviously we said before, it's like 22, could be 24 inches wide.
And again, it depends. Frontal is hard to determine because like front on, full frontal, yeah, I would say that's pretty uncommon to experience in the woods, like an elk that is fully frontal. It's a pretty fine line between being quartering to you, like too much, and being enough that I can actually snake an arrow in inside the shoulder blade.
I'm having a hard time with this one, Trail.
You are? How so?
I don't know if I would take the shot. Just me personally. Again, everyone else can do what they want to do. It just seems like the problem is though, you're going to get down, what is it? You're going to be hunting multiple days. Day 7, finally this comes to fruition. Bull comes right in. Bull comes to, let's say, 15 yards straight on to me. Haven't any opportunities since then. Would I take that shot or not? That's what I'm trying to think about in my head right now.
Would you? 15 yards at a 12-inch pie plate?
15 yards, totally 12-inch pie plate. I don't know. Maybe not. I still think I might wait and hope it turns.
Why?
I don't know. I just don't know. The frontal with the bow. I know it's lethal. I've seen that there's a viral video out there. I don't know who put it out there. So sorry, but someone shoots this like kid.
Oh yeah.
Shots that bull in the front and just like stands there and all of a sudden just like, boom, tips right over. I don't think it takes a step.
It's just pouring blood.
Pouring blood.
Yep.
I guess you would have to know at that time, like you said, exactly where it's facing, your nerves, are you shaking or whatever? Because a bull coming in is also pretty intimidating.
Oh, yeah. Wait,
it's a bunch of giant swords sticking out the top of their head.
Absolutely. Especially when they're facing head on.
Facing head on.
And you're nervous that you're going to get busted.
Is he going to run at you after you shot? Like, whatever. Who knows? but gosh. I mean, 12 inches is shooting a pie plate at 15, 18 yards is easy. I could probably do it left-handed.
Probably.
In the heat of the moment, day 7, last day of my hunt, if I get presented with that shot, would I take it? I don't know right now. I'm still saying in my head, I probably wouldn't take that shot. But again, you're presented with those situations and it's day 7, knowing all this stuff. This is why I think it's best to be educated on it and know the anatomical references of where their body sits, where their lungs are, all the vitals, all that stuff could play off into it. Maybe I'll switch my decision to a maybe. I don't think I'd like it. I think I would do every other shot quartering away, like totally broadside. I'd be more comfortable with different distances. to a degree, but like, gosh, frontal.
I would rather take a 20. I'll even say I feel more confident taking a 25 yard shot frontal than I do at an elk, broadside at 80.
Yeah.
I would, or broadside at 70.
Yeah.
Okay. To be honest. Yeah, I'm more confident in that shot than I would be at that distance. Yeah, and like I said, the elk that I've shot frontal have been, it's been really quick and awful deadly. I mean, I think this leads to maybe like a larger discussion, right? So you said you don't know if you would or you would not. Like it's a maybe for you, right?
It's kind of a maybe right now, yeah.
See, and I would actually, this is something that like I've been thinking a lot about in the last year, because I hit a bear and I lost it, right? Yeah. I've hit some animals and I've lost them, and this is new to me. Like this has not been the case for me for years and years, like 20 some years of bow hunting. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very little, like one spike elk that I can think of. Haven't lost many animals except for the last couple of years, and it's had me thinking. And the thing I think you need to go into the woods with boundaries, and I think it's a good idea to go into a situation where a shot might present itself and have hard boundaries. Because mm-hmm. in the moment, you can talk yourself into things that you don't feel comfortable with,
yeah,
unless you have a hard and fast boundary. And so that's something I've been thinking a ton. So when you say like, I don't know if I would or I wouldn't, I would do some real soul searching, and I would say, you know what? If I get faced with a frontal shot and it's 20 yards, I will take it. But if it's 25, I won't. Mm-hmm. Or if it's 30, I won't.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That really could be an easy way to do it. Like set it up. See, it's a go or don't go situation. Mm-hmm. 20 and under. Yes.
Yep.
As long as, again, do some soul searching. Figure that out if it's right for you. But yeah, if it's a little bit past that, don't do it. Again, though, it's hard to judge yardages sometimes when you're in the woods. So like, is that shot 20? Is it shot 25? Is it 30? The elk kind of look close. Elk's a big body. Do you think it matters at all? Like a bow setup for someone, or like a broadhead situation too, which should be considered on a frontal, because you are punching through potentially some things that could slow your arrow down.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's a whole lot different than it would be on, you know, an elk that's broadside, to be honest. Okay. Like I think you should be shooting a proper, you know, broadhead arrow setup for your poundage and the amount of energy that you're generating and the foot per second and the weight of the arrow, everything, you know, all things considered. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have any issue with somebody shooting a 50-pound bow, you know, with a fixed blade broadhead that's, you know, 20 yards on a frontal. It's going to penetrate. You're going to get it, right? Mm-hmm. You just got to be able to put it inside that window. And I think you'd have enough energy. But I mean, going back to it, I think this is something that's, I'm really trying to do this year going into the, you know, I'm going into some elk hunts in the next couple of weeks, and I've got one in Arizona, late in November. I'm like really doing some soul searching, and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to set some damn boundaries. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think the thing is the, when you're bow hunting, it's so incredibly hard to get an opportunity.
Yeah.
And when you finally get an animal and he's within range, maybe he's 60 yards or let's say 70 yards, you know, you're like, man, I've shot a lot of arrows this year at 80 and 110. And a lot of those are really good arrows, but they're not all great arrows.
Yeah.
Right. And that elk standing there at 70 yards and you've worked your absolute ass off to get within range, it's really easy to talk yourself into like, maybe this one is going to be the one that hits where I need it to hit and I get him. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's not a strategy that anybody should live by.
No.
And for me, and I think I would encourage everybody, do some real soul searching, be really, really honest with yourself, like about your abilities, and set boundaries. Like I am only going to shoot 60. Anything else is not going to work for me. Like I'm just not going to do it. I'm either 60 or I'm not doing it. Right.
Yeah.
Same thing on kind of the orientation of the animal to you, you know, an elk quartering to you pretty hard, you know, like a nice quartering shot. He's in close and you're like, man, he's right there. And I've worked my tail off to get within range and here's a shot. I'm, you know, I'm probably not going to work out. I'm probably going to hit the front shoulder, but maybe not. that's not a shot that you should take. So like, mm-hmm. I think setting boundaries, even in the orientation of the animal, like I'm only shooting an animal that's broadside, or I'm only shooting an animal that's slightly quartering away. I'm not taking quartering two shots. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm only taking frontals if they're within 20 yards or 25 yards. And I'm only going to take them if I can absolutely see a window into that vital area. You know, I'm not going to force it. And I think, I think setting boundaries prior to is the best way to do it, because it closes the door on situations mm-hmm. where you could talk yourself into taking a shot you shouldn't take.
Yeah, that was really well said, Trail. Nice job.
I don't know. I've been doing a lot of soul searching.
Yeah. The one thing I'll add to this before I let you move on to something else, I can't recall ever, let me say it ever, all caps, exclamation points, gone to a 3D course. I used to shoot 3D archery mm-hmm. all the time. Ever shot a target that's a deer-related target, set up, shooting it straight on in the chest. I don't think many people practice that shot. That's what I'm trying to get at.
That's a good point.
Yeah, the only time you practice it is on a live animal.
Yeah, like that's
when
true.
Has there ever been going to tack a bull elk?
Never.
That's straight on, and that's where you have to shoot it.
Never.
Never.
Not one time that
I can think of. So how many people do you think are actually practicing that to know, like, okay, I shoot it right there, walk up to the 3D target, analyze it, see if it's at the right angle, mm-hmm. the elevation, is it pointing upwards, is it pointing downwards, is it between the two shoulder blades? Can you think of a time you've practiced
Never.
A frontal?
Not one time ever. The only time I've ever taken a frontal shot is on an animal.
Yeah.
Now that you say that, which is, it might speak to the fact that it does feel strange. Mm-hmm. Like the animals that I've shot frontal, it feels odd because it's like I said, you've got this neck, you've got the head, mm-hmm. you've got this extension, and there's the depth between the front of its nose and the actual body cavity, right? Mm-hmm. Like it feels weird to kind of aim in the, you know, neck body area of an animal. Yeah, that's a good point. I haven't.
I think we should do it.
Yeah,
we should get a 3D target.
We could.
And we should go out and set it up and shoot it back. Okay, Trail, where would you hit on this? Let's see if you put it right in the spot, which most likely you will. But then it would be kind of cool. I don't want to do this to I have a cow elk hide at home. It'd be sweet to put a hide on there with the hair all sticking off and like the way it looks still. And let's just practice on this right now in a frontal situation mm-hmm. to see like, obviously you're not going to see like penetration or anything, but to see like anatomically how it looks, get that vision perception going of like when you're going to be faced with that shot. But like, if we're going to be talking about frontal shots, I think we need to incorporate more frontal shots in our practice.
I agree. We need some 3Ds with some realistic frontal opportunities.
Realistic frontal opportunities.
Some
12
rings.
12 rings in the front.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I had never thought about that, but you're right. Yeah, you do never practice it. Mm-mm. I think, and that kind of rises, you know, brings to the front of my mind, like the whole adage, like pick a spot, right? Because mm-hmm. I think if you're going to take a frontal shot, you really do, you're not aiming at something that you practice at, right? Mm-hmm. So you do really need, in those cases, to be aware of a spot to aim at. I think I've been pretty outspoken in that, like a lot of the shots that I've taken, I can remember some where I have picked out a spot, like a tuft of hair, right? Mm-hmm. Like maybe a shadow or spot of sunlight that's like hitting the side of an animal, or a front leg, opposite front leg and a quartering away shot, you know, where you've got a reference to aim for. I think picking a spot is awesome. You should mm-hmm. do it. I can just tell you that I have not always done it. I can't remember it, but that is something that like I'm trying to do. Like I'm trying to be better about that, mm-hmm. you know? So more controlled, setting boundaries, you know, not taking shots, talking myself into it and really focus on trying to pick a spot to the point where I was thinking the other day, I was hunting with my brother. We ended up setting a water hole the one night and, I gave my other brother a bow mm-hmm. and that bow I had written on the back of it in a Sharpie and I'd written win the day, which essentially meant like, give this day that you're out hunting everything that you possibly got, right? Yep. A little reminder to win the day. And then the bow that I've got now, I don't have anything written on it. You know, there's a chance I might be getting a new bow here pretty soon that I'll be, you know, hunting with. And as I was sitting there kind of on this water hole, thinking about elk coming in and thinking about hunting in general and thinking about setting up a bow, I was thinking like, what would I put on the back of my bow? Right. And it might be time for me to put some, you know, words of wisdom on the back of my bow again to reference in the moment. Things like pick a spot.
Yeah.
You know, like,
I like that sort of thing.
Yeah, me too. I think it's great because it's something that you can reference. You look at every arrow that you shoot throughout the summer, and then really in a high stress situation, you can look at that and you get that reminder and you get it built into your psyche.
Oh,
And you look at it. So I was trying to think. So
positive reinforcement.
Positive reinforcement. Yep. So I think the two things, and I was going to have my kid, he's got one of these little Cricut machines that cuts vinyl, you know, I thought, I'll put that on there instead of sharpening it in my shitty handwriting. But I thought, pick a spot. I'm going to go back to that old adage, you know, pick a spot and then go slow, dummy.
Go slow, dummy. I like that one too.
So those are the two I'm kind of thinking of. Hmm. Yeah. Do you do anything like that on your rifles?
I was just thinking about that when you said it. I was like, you can't obviously do anything through the scope, but you could put something on the side of your stock as like a little mantra, sayings, type of thing like that. And like, I do like that. When you said that right now, I'm like, maybe I should.
Yeah.
Like, my girlfriend recently got something that she labeled we have like an olive oil jar, and it's like a nice one, like it actually looks nice to keep on the counter all the time.
It's as much decorative as it is olive oil.
Yeah. And so it's like a guy with those like long needle spouts on it, so it pours out really nice. You know, it's like pop the cork off all your time. And then there's like an avocado oil one or something like that, like a high temp oil. And she labeled them both, so we know which ones they are. And it's one of those little label makers that has like the raised print on it, and it's stuck right on there. So I'm like, when you're thinking about this, I'm gonna try go home, do like a 3-word thing, stick it on the side of my rifle stock as like a little bit of a and positive reinforcement, talking myself through it, like, you know, pressing the shot off or just something random that I'll think about. And it's like sticking on
just
there.
Just press it, Brady.
Press it. press the trigger.
Yeah.
Just like, I think it's either that or like the old motivation, like win the day. Like that's still a really good one. That's not just like, that's when you're carrying around your bow, you'll still see that. Like, I got to work hard today. I need to win the day. Or like, or is it shot focused where you see it and like, okay, focus, pick a spot. Like, I mean, like I have these wristbands always, like this one right here says, believe anything is possible.
Yep.
Just a slight motivation me. I've had another one that says like success is a state of mind. Like I switch between my little wristbands all the time when I'm like doing things. And it's like, that's my little like motivation or something hard happened on a hunt to push myself through it, to keep continuing to hike further or, you know, wake up earlier and go crazy, like whatever it may be. And I think all that stuff is very important when you're out hunting. The mental side of all that stuff.
It's huge.
Is very, very huge.
Yeah. I remember I had Henry Ferguson. Shout out to Henry. He just killed a great buck.
He did. I saw that this morning.
I think he's automatic. Now
you can chase moose finally.
Yeah, automatic on the mule there, it seems like. But I remember talking to I remember talking to Henry, and I remember we were talking about shot execution and shooting a bow and aiming, and I remember saying, you know, my problem really hasn't been aiming. Like I can aim fairly well. It's a lot of my issues of, you know, as far as accuracy goes, are in my back half, like in my release hand, right, and manipulating that. The point is I can aim fairly well if I just remember to do so. Like if I'm mindful in that moment, and aiming at a dot at my local range is infinitely easier than having to remind myself of what pin to use, you know, the yardage, the distance, and then find on an animal, which is kind of a blank canvas, an aiming reference point, right? Like there's so much going on in my mind at that time. So I think, yeah, I need those little reminders. I need something to like bring my focus in in those moments, which I don't have to fight that at the local range when I'm practicing, but I do need it in those moments when I'm hunting elk, because my adrenaline, I get buck fever. Like I've killed animals, a lot of them, with a bow. And I was thinking about it the other day. You know, I was hunting with my brother and we had a bunch of elk kind of working in underneath us, and there were opportunities there. And I was thinking about it after the fact and like, man, my adrenaline was through the roof. And that's a cow or a spike elk, right? Which people might be like, yeah, it's just cow or spike or whatever. But for me,
sometimes I shake so much. When
me
I'm
too.
Like does.
Oh yeah. For
like
sure.
Like whitetails back in the day, like I got so jacked up.
Yeah. I get so excited. And when my adrenaline is pumping through the veins, I need something extra to like bring me back in. And I also have needed or will need to have set some like realistic boundaries prior to that so that I just don't have to question it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Some beta blockers.
Beta blockers. I do need some beta blockers. That would be good. Calm me down.
Pop one of those in once you hear your first bugle. Like, oh, I'm going to get a calm shot today. I got some of these little performance enhancers. They're going to make it so I can nice and steady.
That's it. Yeah, just something. Some a little more mellow. I get too excited. So that's kind of all I had. Anything else that you had?
Yeah, I want to touch on something. Yeah. So, I can't remember what this app was called. So way back in the day, I had this app on my phone. It was like some like bow hunting simulator app that like showed you could like manipulate the deer around. You could put the arrow where you wanted it to, and then it would show like all the vitals on the inside. And it went away. Mm-hmm. I used to have it linked to where it was, and it was like a news piece out of it. It was like way back in the day when like apps were first thing. And but I saw another one's resurfaced lately. I'm not sure when this app came about, but I saw Cliff Gray talking about it. Mm-hmm. And it's a bow hunt simulator app. This bad thing is it's $3.49 to buy. But again, is that $3.49 that is well worth your time and money invested into it to know things? Like, it looks like a pretty sweet app. You can like, you know, add different distances, add yardages, shooting situations, and you could peel back the hide and see where your arrow is going through, what you're going to be hitting. So you could do the frontal on an elk.
Gotcha.
See what it is. You could do side, quartering to, quartering away, all this stuff. And it seems like a pretty cool tool that someone could utilize. I know we have that target in the back.
Quiver.
Yeah, it's the
Quiver AR.
Using the Quiver AR app. Mm-hmm. And you could like, so you could shoot at the target and then turn that app on and point your phone to it. And it's like, I don't know, not augmented reality, but it's like, wild and crazy. Like, you just point it out and it shows your arrow in there and you can see all the vitals and stuff really well. So I think those two are pretty cool. So that bow hunt simulator, having that target and then the Quiver app to be able to look at that stuff. But it's like, there's so many, you know, people always like hate on technology all the time, but like this sort of technology, this educational side, I really enjoy, because like you can, again, put yourself in those situations, peel back the layers of the hide to see actually what you're hitting at and like drop a dot. Like, hey, where was that bull you shot a couple years ago? You know, I want to see exactly where it was. We'll recreate that, recreate how the animal is turning towards you on the app, that where you hit it or thought you hit it, and see what actually is behind there. I think that's just valuable to learn, and knowledge is power. Like I always say, and it's like, that's a cool piece of gear. So I think if I was a bow hunter, $3.50, like, what is that?
Worth it. Yeah, absolutely.
You can't even get a coffee for $3.50 anymore. Yeah. So I think that's cool.
I can at the Maverick.
Yeah. Zero affiliations with them at all, but I think that it's a pretty cool little deal that you guys can utilize. When you're on
I actually
field.
Did think of a couple other things as you were talking that I think are important to note. One of them being, I've had issues over the years actually finding the spot where I shot. So like finding where the animal was. Mm-hmm. So I'm like,
elk was standing here.
Elk was standing here.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've
kind of black out afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of black out. Right. Like, I'm so focused on the animal and making sure that I, you know, pick my window and I'm picking a spot and I'm executing a shot that like where they were exactly standing. There's been a lot of times where I've gone down and looked for my arrow and I'm like 15, 20 yards over one direction to the other. I think it's a really good tip to take note of for elk hunting, right? You have an elk coming in, you know, range the trees around you. We've talked about that a bunch. You want to make sure that you have a good range as close as you possibly can get it to that animal when you execute the shot, but like take note of like features, right? And as soon as you execute that shot, just take a minute to look. After they run off, obviously.
Yeah, see that burnt log that's hanging at a 45-degree angle. You shot near there. So try to reference that and try to remember it quickly before you black out.
Yeah, yeah. My tendency is to like watch the animal, right? So you hit the animal, you watch the animal reaction, the animal, you're going to watch which direction it goes.
Yeah, you're watching them run off and then you're like, oh, now I have to go back. Which gap did I shoot through?
Yeah, which gap? Which was that by? So I would say even it's a good idea to like pull out your phone and take a photo. And then try to recreate it in your mind. That'll help you find the actual spot where you hit and will help you find your arrow and first blood and then on down the line. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how many times I've had that happen where I'm like, shit, I can't find out. I don't know where I shot that animal. I don't remember because I was just so focused on, you know, the situation in front of me.
That's a really good tip. Yeah. To like, you can even do that, should even do that with a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where exactly was that animal standing? Obviously, if it has snow and it's late season, it's a little bit easier.
Yep.
But, like, know where it is. That way you can go over there to look. Okay, here's the first tracks. This is the direction it's going. Maybe shot on a ridge and it mm-hmm. went off to the other side. Do you, in those terms, do you feel, like, let's say you felt like you made a perfect shot.
Mm-hmm.
Felt great. You walk over there, you can't find the arrow.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like a really defeating thought for a while? Like you yes. can't find your arrow? Like
yeah.
that's something you absolutely want to be able to find to be able to try to recover that elk.
It's nice.
Nice. Yeah.
It's great.
It has some reassurance in your head.
Ideally you get a pass through, right?
Yeah.
I do feel better if I find blood and they don't bleed right away all the mm-hmm. time. Like it can take a second, so they may not bleed. You may not have any blood hit in the dirt for like 20, 30 yards. Mm-hmm. It depends on the shot. Obviously if you hit high, like high lung, they're not, it's going to kill them. It's going to kill them quick. Actually, high lung will probably kill them as quick as anything, right? But you're not going to get a ton of blood because it's so far up on the, you know, the side, right? So it takes time for that blood to come down the side and actually hit the dirt. So you may not actually find blood for 20, 30, 40 yards, to be honest. But yeah, finding the arrows, like first and foremost, I want to find that arrow. I want to see what it looks like. I want to be able to analyze it. I want to look at the blood on it. I want to mm-hmm. see if there's any meat or fat on it. That's like my first step. And then after that, actually finding blood itself and starting to evaluate, like, what does the blood look like? Is there bubbles in it? Is it bright red? Is it, you know, brown and kind of gunky yeah. looking? Is it, you know, muscle looking blood, right? And all those kinds of things are going to like help you determine what you do. And I think that's probably a good place to kind of wrap up at least my portion of this. And if you got other things you want to say, but, time frame.
Okay.
So you shoot.
Yep.
Kind of my rule of thumb is like a half hour. Like I'm going to get a half hour before I move. Like I'm just going to sit there. I'm going to wait right where I'm at. I'm going to like get my wits about me. I'm going to mm-hmm. try to get a general good idea of where I think that animal was standing when I executed the shot. I'm going to look at my maps. I'm going to consider where I saw the animal run. Obviously, unless I heard him like crash or die, right? So mm-hmm. I'm going to give it a half hour. Then I'm going to go look for spot where it was standing. I'm going to look for my arrow. And if I can't find my arrow, I'm going to start looking for tracks and blood.
Yep.
Okay. And then that's going to dictate on what I do with the rest of the blood trail. So if I find my arrow and it's gunky, it looks green and brown and nasty, like it's a gut shot, I would say 12 to 18 hours.
Mm.
So I'm leaving it.
You're leaving. You're not even going to go say, hey, maybe I'll go creep over here 100 yards, look over this little hill.
Nope. Like
backing out.
I'm done. I'm done looking any further and I'm being as quiet as I possibly can. Cause a lot of time a gut shot animal won't go all that far mm-hmm. and it'll lay down. Right.
This is a good tip.
Yeah. So dead quiet, super silent, low profile, even back out if you have to. Like just disconnect yourself from that, play the wind even, cause you don't want that animal to catch your wind again, get up and move off. Like 12 to 18 hours, I would say for a gut shot, right? Liver, which can be a little bit, it can look slimy too, right? So liver bud is generally, like I said, a dark maroon. And I would say at a minimum, like 4 hours, at least I would say, and maybe longer. Just on the safe, to be on the safe side. So again, back out, be mindful of wind and everything. Lung blood, like after a half hour, if it's frothy pink, I'm going to take up the blood trail it out. And I'm going to find my bull within probably 100 yards, 200 yards max.
Do you think you still find frothy blood a half hour later?
Yeah. I mean, you'll see,
you'll still see it. Yeah, it's not as yeah. like dried up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll kind of see the bubbles in it, you okay. know, the way that it looks. I mean, other tips in regards to like blood trailing, blood that's been on the ground or like on a log or leaf or anything like that, the longer it's been there, the darker it's going to look.
Mm.
So just be aware of it. But yeah, I mean, telltale signs of a lung hit are those bubbles, right? So I'm looking for that. An elk that's heart shot, it's going to be bright red blood and it's typically going to go real quick and die. Like we're talking, it might be like 30 seconds at the most. Mm-hmm. It's probably 10 seconds. I mean, it's going to die pretty quick and you'll probably hear it crash. But yeah, let the blood trail kind of dictate what you do. And those are kind of my references. Half hour, gut shot, 12 to 18, liver, I'm thinking like 4+.
Okay. I got one last thing for you.
Yep. What you got?
Do you have any, and maybe I'll describe mine first. You can think of kind of how I'm phrasing this, but do you have any hard, fast set rules when it comes to shot placement or taking a shot at an animal?
Do I have any hard, fast
rules of like, you will not do this at all if this presents itself, not at all anymore, no way I'm taking a shot because of whatever situation is going on. Mm-hmm. And I'll explain, again, it's probably a horrible phrase in that question, sorry. But my hard, fast set rule that will not break anymore, which I did the one time, and everyone knows why I retired from bow hunting. Mm-hmm. I took a 51-yard shot at a 200-plus-inch deer walking.
Mm-hmm.
Because I bumped him literally an hour and a half earlier at like 25 yards and I didn't want to stop him. I had another like 175 inch buck bedded like 40 yards from me. So I didn't want to make a noise, have him give up, get up, have something weird going on, or didn't want to make a noise and stop, make that buck like bolt off running. So I took a shot at a walking buck at 51 yards, thought I could do it. Never practiced it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're talking about, and hit that buck last rib, lost it.
Yeah.
Don't know if it thrived. Don't know if it died. I think it died because all the blood that was coming out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, gave it 27 hours or whatever before I went and looking for it.
Yep.
And never recovered it. So my rule now, from now on, if I ever get back into bow hunting, hopefully I do,
mm-hmm.
I am never, ever, ever taking a shot at a walking animal. I don't care if it's 10 yards in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
I think too much shit goes wrong. Take a shot at a walking animal. So that's something that it sucks that I learned that lesson when I did mm-hmm. on like the biggest animal of my life.
Yeah.
And I lost an animal, wasted that animal's life. I don't know if he survived. So hopefully he did, but all signs point to he's dead. And, it just hurt so much to know that I took a walking shot because I was too stupid in my deep thoughts. I was like, oh, I can make the shot.
Yeah.
That was a time when I was literally a bow hunter. So all I did was bow hunt.
Right.
3D, did everything, tournaments, mm-hmm. all sorts of shit.
Yeah.
Took a walking shot at 51 yards.
Yep.
In that totally, I can't blame everything else, but I can blame myself in that situation for taking a 51-yard shot because I got so caught up in the moment, like I can make this.
Yeah.
So that is my rule that I'll never break, never shoot a walking animal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would tell you that prior to maybe like the last year, like I've never really like had hard and fast boundaries. Like I've never been, I've been like, yeah, it's situational, you know, I'll figure it out as I go. I may or I may not. Right. Just depends on what it gives me. So, and I have been thinking about this a ton. So I do have some. I won't take a shot at a walking animal either because mm-hmm. one, I'm not good at taking like, so if you, some of our local 3D shoots that I've been to before, you know how they have like the moving target, like yeah. where it's on a rope swing or whatever it might be. Right. I suck at those. Like mm-hmm. I'm terrible at them. I've never shot them well. You know, if I do hit the target, it's always back. Like I just am not good at anticipating and leading an animal and actually mm-hmm. executing a shot. I shoot a hinge release for the most part. So like timing a shot for me on a moving target is not good. I'm not good at it. So I won't take a shot on a walking animal. So mm-hmm. that's definitely one for me. I'm not going to shoot an animal over 70. Like that's, and I shoot a lot and mm-hmm. I shoot pretty decent groups at 80. I'm mm-hmm. not the best ever by any means. I'm not saying that. Definitely, you know, lethal, but 70 is kind of like it for me. Like my groups open up at 80 and for me at that distance, like broadside or ever so slightly quartering away is mm-hmm. like the most I'm willing to do. And it has to be like dead calm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It has to be perfect. I'm not taking a shot on a quartering two animal. Like, not going to do it. There's just the margin error is too slim, right? Mm-hmm. If he's more frontal and I think I can sneak it inside the shoulder blade, like he has to be more frontal than quartering to me. So I'm not going to do that. I'm not taking a Texas heart shot. Definitely not doing that. What other boundaries do I have? You think any, those are probably it. Those are the ones
mm-hmm.
I'm not taking a frontal. I've made frontals, longer frontals. But again, I don't want to lose animals. Like it's the shittiest feeling in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have to be really close and I'd have to be feeling like really confident and it'd yeah. have to be the right situation at the right time. And that one I will kind of evaluate, but I'm going to say 30 yards is probably max for that.
Yeah. Cause I just thought of that based on what we were saying earlier about like, can't remember what you said exactly, but yeah, basically setting boundaries for yourself and having like a soul searching conversation with yourself to figure out something you should live and die by. And then like, yeah, the walking thing to me was just like, that's that one learning moment that I wish I didn't have to learn that way.
Yep.
I wish it was a better outcome. And I still maybe could have learned from that. Like maybe I recovered it, but realized I shouldn't walk, but like, or take a shot at a walking animal.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean like we should probably do a rifle version of this.
Yeah, we should.
Because like I would take slightly walking shot on a rifle depending on distance. Yeah.
And I wouldn't, I just can't. I don't know why.
Depending on distance, I would do it. And that's why I think a whole nother conversation on this. On the other side of it with a rifle could be kind of good, and like shot placement with a rifle, because like it's important stuff to be thinking about and to just be aware about all the times that where you're going to place a arrow, where you're going to place a bullet, like what's it going to do, all the other. Oh, maybe I got one more question for you. Does weather have an impact?
Weather
on with arrow flight.
Oh yeah. I think rain, like in a downpour. You're going to hit lower. Yeah. And it's hard to say exactly how much.
Next you did the video. That's why I just remembered asking about it.
Yeah. And I don't think it's due to like your equipment being wet or your strings being wet. I just think it's due to, your arrow and your veins cutting through moisture
all
and
that rain. Drag.
Yeah. So I think you're going to hit lower. I think it'd be ideally, you know, you should know how much. So that's a great tip. Like if you're in a downpour and by some means you have a bull walk in and you get a shot, like it's probably not a shot you want to take at like 60, 70 yards or even 50, to be honest, because I can't tell you how much it's going to drop.
You don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know if there's a break in the weather out in front of you, the rain, or is it heavier out in front of you because you're in the cover and it's absolutely downpouring where that bull is. What about wind? Is it too windy certain shots?
I mean, I think it depends on like how much you've practiced it and then like how confident you feel. Like I've had shots or opportunities where I've pulled back and it's just been too windy. Like I can't get my pin to settle and I've had to let down. So like if I can't get my pin to settle relatively well, then yeah, it's too windy and I'm not going to take a windy shot. Mm. Yeah. It just, that one's a little bit more situational. It's just going to depend on, you know, how the wind feels and what my aim looks like. But it's like I said, I've hunted long enough and I've had enough mishaps that I can tell you that like, it's so hard to get within bow range, and you can talk yourself into all kinds of things because you want it. You want it so bad. I know.
It's right there for the grasp.
I know.
You can already taste the stakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, you know, success is so close. But then, yeah, talking yourself into something you're not comfortable doing. That's the hard part.
You can do it. And I can tell you the only thing worse than that is just making a shitty shot and not finding the animal.
And everyone, like I said earlier, I wouldn't take a frontal shot. But I honestly, I need to do some soul search. Would I still do it in that situation? Day 7, last day, never had a shot opportunity. And is that the right or wrong choice? I don't know. It's like you have to just feel that out.
I just think you need to know. I think you walk away. If you've made the decision, you walk away from that feeling okay about it. Like if you've made the decision prior to, you're never going to question it. You're going to say, yeah, that was the right decision. And you're going to feel great about it. You're going to sleep great at night.
Yeah.
If you go into those situations and you don't know what you're going to do, you're always going to look back on that and you're going to think, oh, I don't know, maybe I should have, maybe I shouldn't. You're going to be kicking your own ass. Whereas if you make the decision, you're going to walk away from that feeling like, you know what? I exercise self-control. That felt good. That animal's alive. I don't have to worry about it. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So that's kind of all I had. Good luck to people. We're going to be doing some more podcasts in the next week and a half. And then, I'm peeling out. The guys and I are going to go hit, Wyoming real hard. And we're going to go out and see if we can get some archery elk on the ground.
You see, Porter's been practicing a lot.
Has he?
It seems like a lot. And I'm putting quotes up there because I do walk out every now and then. I see him walking around with his bow.
I hope so.
And then I asked him yesterday, he's like, you shoot your bow? He's like, oh yeah, often. And then I was thinking about it, yeah, I actually saw you on like Thursday shooting it last week. I saw you on Wednesday shooting it, like a lot.
So I hope so.
I'm excited for him.
I hope so. No, it'll be good. But I mean, anybody listening, I hope it helped out a little bit, and good luck. Shoot straight.
September's here for all you elk nuts.
It's the best month of the whole year.
No, that's November.
All right. Thanks, Brady.
All right. Thank you, Trail.
Bye.